Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of an evening with Dalton Higgins, in which he discusses his latest book, Far From Over, The Music and Life of Drake. Francesca D'Amico served as host for the event, which was held in December 2012 at Accents on Eglinton, a community bookstore in Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
I'd like to welcome you to our event tonight, Far From Over, an evening with Dalton Higgins. I'd first like to introduce myself for those of you who do not know me in the room. My name is Francesca D'Amico. Some of you may know me via Twitter. My handle is HipHopScholar82. So by day, I'm actually a PhD student at York University studying the history and development of urban music over the course of the 20th century. Tonight, Dalton and I will be engaging in a discussion of his new book titled Far From Over, The Music and Life of Drake. For those of you who may not know, Dalton is widely credited as Canada's foremost expert on hip-hop culture. Dalton Higgins, who you can also tweet tonight via his handle, DaltonHiggins5, is an award-winning journalist, music programmer, pop culture critic, television and radio broadcaster, who has contributed to the work of the CBC, Much Music, Harbourfront, Now Magazine, The Source, and Vibe Magazine, to name a few. There are many more attached to his biography. Dalton is also an author of a number of books, including Fatherhood 4.0, Hip Hop World, Much Master T, and of course his recent book under discussion this evening, in which he explores the life and career of one of Toronto's most famous musical experts, Aubrey Drake Graham. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Dalton Higgins. So we're going to get right into it, and I'd like to ask you, as any historian would, because this is what we're always interested in, is the process by which you went through the research process in putting this book together. So can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write the book about Drake, and why at this particular juncture in his career?
Okay, absolutely. So first of all, I have to thank you all for coming out this cold. It's kind of chilly outside tonight, but temperature seems to have dropped over the last couple hours. And also, I'd like to thank Accents Bookstore for hosting this event, and the badperm.com, which is a fantastic website, and also ActiveHistory.ca, so the folk up at York University that are supporting Francesca's scholarship. So I'd like to thank you all for being involved in this event. Okay, yeah, so as far as Drake, hey, what's up, Chris? So as far as Drake, I mean, it's an interesting thing, my third book. So this book, Far From Over, The Music and Life of Drake, it's my fifth book. My third book was a title called Hip Hop World. Is anybody in here at all familiar with that title, by show of hands? Okay, a couple of you, all right. And so Hip Hop World, in the book, what I argued, this book here, Far From Over, is a natural extension, carryover from Hip Hop World, in that in the book I argued, what I did is I talked about how hip hop culture is being sort of enjoyed and explored and engaged around the world, across the seven continents, right? So for a lot of folk who are, you know, maybe baby boomers, a little older, maybe not so much tapped into hip hop culture or rap music in particular, they tend to have this view about hip-hop being this thing that people, you know, singularly in the hood, people who are, you know, just black or Latin American from the hood, are enjoying, engaging, participating in the culture. And in hip-hop world, you know, I make the case that the hip-hop world that you knew of yesteryear, that's been blown up. It's a different, it's a new hip-hop, it's a hip-hop world and you're just living in it, and it's completely different from, let's say, the 80s and 90s. And what I meant by that is that I essentially, in the first chapter, there's a chapter called The Audacity of Hip-Hop, and that's a riff off of the biography on Barack Obama called The Audacity of Hope, right? Mm-hmm. So I call it The Audacity of Hip-Hop. And in it, I basically make the claim that people have a tendency to look at the epicenters of hip-hop as being, you know, New York City, right, as far as it being a birthright, you know, the New York City, going back to Kool Herc and some of the, you know, the American origins of the music culture and art form. People look at places like L.A., certainly. You know, there's an artist named Kendrick Lamar who just put something out, so people always point back to, you know, N.W.A., some of Dr. Dre and some of the formations happening out there, and some of the early origins is around b-boying, popping and locking. People point to things like down south, you know, as far as Atlanta, et cetera, et cetera. But the hip-hop world of today, it's you're looking to places, you're looking to Europe, you're looking to South Asia, and you're looking to a place like Canada. So in the chapter, I pretty much, prophesized, that never mind New York, never mind LA, never mind down south, it's going to be places like Toronto, actually, where you're going to see some of the future rap stars of tomorrow. So I said that the book came out in early 2009, and I talked a bit about how Drake, look out for people like Drake, look out for people like Kanan, who's a Somali-Canadian, rapper, Waving Flag, you all know that song, from Etobicoke originally, lives in L.A. now. You're going to be looking to places like Canada. You're going to be looking to obscure places that weren't so much on the hip-hop map during hip-hop's genesis, the 80s and 90s. So that's kind of like, it was a natural evolution to work on this project, because people, when I wrote that in that chapter, they're going like, really? You think people are going to start looking at Toronto, Canada as being the place where the world is going to be now looking at for, future rap stars? Some people thought it was a bit nuts. But Drake is living proof. There's an artist called The Weeknd, right? He does like this futuristic strain of R&B and soul. And this guy is he is huge in the U.S. When I was there with my brother in New York, it's like people are like, The Weeknd, do you know The Weeknd? Do you know Drake? The world is talking about Toronto. And Torontonians tend to be typically conservative by nature. There's a bit of humility. We're not used to having the spotlight, the music spotlight on us, so to speak. But when you travel outside of these borders, when you go outside of Toronto, and everybody's playing Drizzy and The Weeknd and Kanan all the time, then you're like, whoa, the world is has its light shining on Toronto right now. So that was part of the reason for writing a book about Drake. Now, as a pop culture critic for many years, for eons, it's interesting too, because there's a guy here named Clifton Joseph, who's a legendary dub poet, who right here, right, where I would say, with me, some humility, I learned some of the tricks of the trade, around how to report, with some objectivity, neutrality, how to be very, nonpartisan. So when you talk about an artist, what I'm saying for those who aren't journalists or academics, it's like in the industry now, when people report about things, they're not going at the subject with any kind of, they're just, how do you say, like you're very... You're not going at it with any... it's not fair. You're just kind of saying, yeah, Kanan, he's from Etobicoke. I'm from Rexdale. He's the best. But you're not really taking the chance to sort of break down his tracks, with any kind of, objectivity. So I work out of the tradition of folk like Clifton Joseph, where, he used to work, the CBC for many years. I've had the opportunity to do some projects with the CBC, recently the CBC Hip Hop Summit. But, I have no issue if somebody's not essentially representing the city of Toronto well, or a lot of their rhymes are filled with, lies, distortion of truth, I have no issue calling them on it, right? And so essentially, being a pop culture reporter for many years, I sort of pride myself on my ability to keep my finger on the pulse of sort of what's hot and what's not, right? So when I see somebody like Kanan, I produced his first concert, right? His first concort ever, like February 2005 at the Harborfront Center, right? And then he got a cover story. He got a big story in the Globe and Mail, a big story in this newspaper called I Weekly. He was on the cover of that. And I have a lot of stories to tell like that, where people say, oh yeah, I know Ghetto Concept, I know these bands, and I've been doing this so long, that's like, yeah, I did one of their first shows. In fact, Drake, I had booked him at the Harborfront Center to do a concert, he was part of Urban Music Association of Canada, musician sort of showcase. And this was before he sort of took off, right? So I keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on in the music community, and then try to report that either in a magazine or newspaper or in book form, right? So this is why I felt this would be a great project to do right now.
Okay, fantastic. So when you were putting together the biography, I'm sure that there's all kinds of positive things that you can tell us about the process, but were there any challenges that you came across when putting together this book?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a ton of challenges. Now, the one, because Toronto is so new to having the global spotlight on it, what it means is when you're trying to track down interviews, there's like a joke inside the sort of music journalist circle where they'd say, hey, I'd have an easier time, getting an interview with Jay-Z than I would an MC from Regent Park. You know what I mean? Is that what I find in Toronto, because the scene is sort of a little less... I wouldn't say less like underdeveloped, but we've never really had a music infrastructure to support the artists here, right? So when you look at the history of the music, it's great that we're doing this event on Eglinton. A lot of the sort of rap music, early rap music retentions in Toronto actually come from, are an outgrowth from things happening on Eglinton, right? So there's a lot of historical significance that's even hanging out here. So when I say that, what do I mean? Anybody here know who Mishy Me is, right? By show of hands, Mishy Me, right? Okay, right. So she is affectionately referred to as Canada's First Lady of Rap, and I've known her date going back to, I'd say, about 1982. Okay, and this was before Michi Mee was Michi Mee. She was just Michelle, and you know, Michi Mee. So we used to hang out on this at this shop out on Eglinton called Monica's. It's still out there. I implore you all to, if you're not from the neighborhood, to do a little tour of my neighborhood. It's a store called Monica's, and it's a cosmetics shop. You know, they sell I don't know, like hair weaves and stuff like that. You know, different hair products or what have you. But it used to be one of the foremost places to get music, to get records. Right. So my father, back in the early 80s, both parents are from Jamaica, he used to, you know, go to his job every Friday after work, take a portion of his paycheck and go and buy vinyl records at Monica's, because it's one of the few places in Toronto, if you want to get your reggae fix, you know what I mean? You want to get your reggae, you know, music, and in addition to getting your jerk chicken and patties and all that kind of stuff. That's where the vast majority of, African Canadians would come out to Eglinton to get, you know, some, you know, black music. If you wanted to get black music, including not just reggae, but, you know, a little bit of calypso, things that kind of remind one of home. You know, if you were of Caribbean descent, you'd come hang out in Eglinton. And if you didn't come out and hang out in Eglinton, you'd come hang out, Bathurst and Bloor. That was another pocket of activity where you could get literature, you know, Thoreau books, different types of things, right? Get your hair cut, that kind of thing, right? So as far as, anyways, back to, you know, as far as challenges, yeah, a lot of challenges are, again, it's trying to get interviews. You know, I'm calling people, you know, I've been embedded in the scene for a long time, so having them understand the gravity, the nature of the project, is that it's a book there, essentially a literary project to sort of celebrate Drake's early contributions. He's only put out two full-length official CDs, but to celebrate his contributions to Toronto, you know, hip-hop in particular, but I think music culture in general, right? So I'll give you a couple anecdotes. People ask me, I mean, the book is unauthorized, right? Because that's one of the big questions. Now, when you're writing a book, the first book I wrote was a book about, it's a book about the history of Much Music as seen through the eyes of one of its most celebrated VJs, which was this guy named Master T, right? Why was Master T important in his about 20 years being at Much Music, about 11 or 12 of them as a VJ, is he was African-Canadian. He wore his, dreadlocks or locks proudly. And this is at a time when, even to this day, I mean, can you point me to, African-Canadian males on television, whether it's popular culture or in news, that are wearing locks, or just black men in general? I mean, you can point maybe on one hand how many figures there are that are like that. So he, and he was also a guy, whenever you had a big artist in town, you know, from Madonna to J-Lo, Michael Jackson's sister, the late Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, every big artist used to come in town, he was the guy who would do all the interviews at Much Music, right? So what I learned with that project, with all, you know, due respect to Master T and the book, which it did sold quite well, is when you work with a subject on a book, it's not going to be as unfiltered and as unvarnished as you'd like it to be, right? So what that means is, if I had worked on, I'm going to maybe put this out there, but let's say I had worked on the book with Drake, you know, to say, hey, okay, we're going to think, A, would not have maybe come out, you know, to kind of, it's kind of like you have your 15 minutes of fame. I don't know when his are going to run out. I don't know if people will be talking about Drake, you know, 3-5 years from now. It's a lot of issues around control when you're working with a subject, right? So I know there's this guy Touré. He's a journalist from the U.S., for example. He's working on a biography about Nas's life, right? Mm-hmm. Who is arguably one of the, you know, greatest MCs of all time. And what ends up happening when you're working with a subject is they kind of tell you where to go, what not to include, and this type of thing, right? So you have a lot of issues there, right? But nevertheless, I spoke to Drake's lawyer, who I've known for quite some time, and he really wanted to sort of have us sit down in a room and connect and figure out a way, you know, this would be a great idea to sort of pursue this book project, but there was no real response, you know, from Drake's camp, you know. They don't, he made something like, I think about maybe $43 million or something like that last year, I think, according to Forbes. So this guy's making crazy amounts of money. Good luck trying to get through to Drake. Good luck trying to get through to Kanan. Mm-hmm. Me, despite having produced his first concert in 2005 and selling it out, him getting all of this media, me connecting them to their first agent, it's very difficult to get through to them to this day, you know. And I'm, you know, you dig what I'm saying? And I was in there from the jump, right? Mm-hmm. I wrote his first bio, you know, his biography, all that kind of thing. It's hard to get phone calls returned. You understand? Mm-hmm. So those are the types of things that you're dealing with when you're putting together projects like this, right? That's a challenge. Another challenge too is, When I talk about Drake's life in the book, you know, not without revealing too much, right? You know, grab a copy, we have some for sale. It's sort of getting the backstory to his inside crew, right? So when you talk about 40, right, Noah Shabib, like one of his producers, you know? You know, one of the challenges, you know, you're digging deep now. These guys, before they were Drake's right-hand man or right-hand producer, before Oliver was Drake's stylist, right? Oliver is the guy you always see next to him as stylist. These guys were doing other things. These guys were, like, working retail at the clothing stores, at, you know, at Queen and John, you know what I mean? Other guys were selling beats for, like, you know, $200 a beat, right? So you're trying to really go deep, and sometimes there's a bit of pushback, right? Because you're revealing a lot of intimate details about Drake and his camp, right? Thankfully and luckily, because, you know, I've, you know, earned a bit of respect in the industry as somebody who's going to report it and be very factual and kind of keep it real, so to speak, I was able to dig a bit deeper. You know, somebody like Oliver, his stylist, yeah, I sort of tell the story of where he's coming from, because people say, Drizzy, you know, he's so dapper and he's so sartorially and stylistically polished and all that. So I tell the story of how, you know, some of the people behind the scene, they used to hang out at, you know, around the Much building, they used to work retail and all this kind of thing, right? So those are some of the challenges. Yeah.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So now let's actually jump into the details of the book, because okay, I think that's what everybody's really looking for. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that I'd like to touch upon, as a hip-hop historian, I've learned that throughout hip-hop history, it seems that an MC's geographical roots, or what we would say their breeding grounds, this has been really central to shaping notions of authenticity, particularly when it comes to class. And you mentioned this, you know, when you're talking about the ideas of the hood, right? And that oftentimes what we're really talking about, or what's coded in that language, is blackness, right? Issues right. of blackness mm-hmm. and tying it to class and poverty and these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at Drake, his biography, we know him to be someone who's come to us or come to the world from a place, a little known place called Forest Hill in Toronto. And so early on in your book, you do a fantastic job of deconstructing his relationship to Forest Hill. So can you talk to us a little bit about Drake's spatial ties to Toronto, as well as his relationship to the American South? Because for those of you who do not know, Drake spent some time in Memphis as well, outside of Toronto, that is. And so can you talk to us about those things and how ideas of authenticity and place really do intersect with one another?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because despite Drake producing two outside of the mixtapes, you know what I mean, Thank Me Later, Take Care, that are, you know, both certified platinum records, what I found is in a lot of my research and interviewing people for the book is that he's still kind of like this polarizing figure. So on the one hand, you have people, you know, Drake files, you know, Drake supporters. He's doing something that no Toronto rapper has ever come close to doing, not even close, right? So when you look at the, you know, the narrative of, you know, Canada's, you know, like somebody like Maestro, the artist formerly known as Maestro Fresh West, you look at, you know, Michi Me, you look at Ghetto Concept, you look at Shaw Clair, right, who had some success back in the day, and you look at sort of the Canadian rap narrative, and nobody's even come remotely close in the area of sales, you know, just hard sales. So Cardinal Official, you know what I mean, that's my homie, he's one of Canada's you know, Canada's great rap ambassador, and but when you look at you know, scans and sales, you know, and downloads and social media clout, there's nobody that's even come anywhere near Drake. Okay, so when you look at Maestro, you know, some of the records, you know, I've sold 100,000 records, right? If you're lucky, 200,000 records, this type of thing. Drake is, you know, it's gonna be 1.5 million, 2 million. It's not something that a lot of people can relate to. So that's one of the things that, you know, we talk about. He is polarizing, right? So some people love him. Now, the whole Forest Hill thing is, you know, you'd ask me, the first question is, you know, why write the book, or why should I write the book? I felt that I think I understand his narrative, maybe more so than most journalists. And part of the reason is, you know, while all of you all that aren't from here are done doing your tour of the section they call Little Jamaica or the Little Caribbean, you know, where Monica's record shop is, just east of there is a neighborhood called Forest Hill, right? Now, Forest Hill is, you know, when I last checked, anyways, research for the book, and having grown up around here, it's the, you know, the second, it's always the second or third wealthiest enclave in Canada. So what that means is, you know, houses over there, and it's not far from a Little Jamaica or a Little Caribbean. It's literally a 15-minute walk from here. You know, the average house costs, you know, about $1.1 million, over $1 million. You know, so it's one of the wealthiest parts in Canada, not Toronto, but in Canada, right? So it's always second or third wealthiest place in Canada. And now, what that means in the, as you look through a hip hop prison from the hip hop frame of reference, is this kid is he's disingenuous, he's not authentic. He went to school in a rich area that is very homogenous homogenous, meaning ain't a lot of black, brown, or people of color over on that side of the tracks. And how do I know this? I went to school over there, right? So when we talk about Drake's narrative and people sort of tease him, you know, this kind of like, oh, the Forest Hill rapper or the Fresh Prince of Forest Hill, he can't, you know, this guy's not genuine, this guy's not hardcore, this guy's not hip-hop, you know, he went to school in Forest Hill, come on, let's be real. He's not from Regent Park, he's not from Parkdale, he's not from Jane Finch, he's not from, you know what I mean? So that narrative, I actually understand having grown up, you know, in the Little Jamaica neighborhood that neighbors Forest Hill. So I went to school in Forest Hill. So when he talks a lot in a lot of it, I talk about it in the book, he was teased mercilessly in school for being a person of color. You know, he's biracial. He's, you know, half, you know, Caucasian Jewish. His mother's Jewish and his father is African-American from the American South. So he was, you know, teased in school. He felt like an outsider going to school in Forest Hill, where it's quite homogenous, right? Where it's very large, you know, Jewish communities, Eastern European communities. Don't see a lot of people that look like myself or even Drake in Forest Hill, you know, at the schools in the neighborhood at all. In fact, which is, it's kind of sad and ridiculous, but, you know, I talk about sometimes the only time the people of color you see in Forest Hill, which is only a 50-minute walk from here, it's nannies, to be perfectly honest, right? So if you take a walk from, you know, Eglinton West subway station, and you walk a little, you know, you can walk maybe, I'm thinking over to even Bathurst or something like Bathurst and Eglinton, sometimes the only people of color you see, people from racialized communities, are nannies, to be perfectly honest, right? Yeah. So... I think, yeah, so that, as far as the narrative, yeah, I really understood that because, you know, I kind of embody that, you know, myself. Like, I went there and I was like, wow, you know, growing up and, you know, going to school, West Prep and forth, I was like, man, this is kind of crazy, really homogenous. And just to get back to your question, yeah, because there's something else I wanted to say there.
About the issue of authenticity,
yeah. Authenticity
and class.
Yeah. Yeah, so the whole Forest Hill thing oftentimes comes up, right? So, and to this day in Toronto. Toronto has this nickname, people call it, rappers, they call it the Screwface Capital, mm-hmm. right? This local rapper that goes by the name of Theology 3, he sort of coined that term, the Screwface Capital, in that people here spend so much time kind of like a crabs in the barrel because we maybe haven't seen so much success in the rap community in general or the music or the music community overall, you know, in the black community, people are trying to drag people down and kind of thing. That you know, that's one of the theories. But yeah, I think that's what it is, though. You know, it's a lot of that, yeah.
Right, okay. So you did mention that Drake is biracial, right? So
that's
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We know that he is the son of a Jewish Canadian mother and yeah. African American father from Memphis.
Yeah.
So can you, in your opinion, I should say, do you think that his racial and ethnic makeup have affected the way that he's been received in the broader hip hop world? And what do you think his ethnic and racial kind of makeup? What do they tell us about the history of race and ethnicity in Toronto? And perhaps, I'm thinking, because you do have a chapter in which you talk about the Juno diss, right?
Right.
The notorious story about how Drake is invited to host the Junos and yet he doesn't win any awards, right?
That's right.
So do you think that this has any effect, right? The issues of race and ethnicity in both our city and perhaps... you know, broader than that in terms of thinking about the Canadian music market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is there a relationship, I
yeah,
guess?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, over the, yeah, I guess it would be about 17 years of, you know, reporting on popular culture and issues around certainly politics, civic engagement, music culture, race and ethnicity, like those are my areas of expertise. I wanted to go at Drake from that viewpoint, you know, to talk about race, you know, to talk about race in a world where race does matter. What I found is a lot of reporters, you know, in Toronto, you know, they have this tendency to sort of tiptoe around these types of issues, around him being certainly, you know, Jewish and, mm-hmm. you know, dig a bit deeper, him being, his father being African-American from the American South, tiptoe around the issues, maybe not wanting to offend, but, you know, in my estimation, you know, race does matter. So if I would use the same approach if it were, you know, a South Asian MC, a Sri Lankan female MC, that or FemC, mm-hmm. that it came, you know, that came out and blew up, or, you know, Latin American MC that blew, is to try to dig a bit deeper. So in the book, yeah, I spend, you know, a considerable amount of time talking about, you know, race, Drake and race, right? So... for one, you know, in the first chapter, I talk about certainly when you're coming from a town like Toronto, I never, you know, I kind of write that in my lifetime, I never thought I'd see, and this is coming from a African-Canadian male position, in my lifetime, I never really thought that I would see a rapper from Toronto that that you know is from a racialized community, sort of blow up and blow up so large, you know, and comparable to Barack Obama, right? So for people that are a little older, that are like older, you know, like over 20, over 30 or 40, a lot of people say like, "Whoa, in my lifetime, I never truly believed I'd see, tennis players like the Williams sisters." Being some of the best tennis players in the world, as far as the Williams sisters. Seriously, if you grew up, if you're over like 30 or 40, you're like, no, I never thought that you'd see a time, you know, tennis, Williams sisters, never thought I'd see, you know, Time Warner, one of its ex-presidents, Richard Parsons, an African-American, the wealthiest woman in North America, billionaire, Oprah Winfrey, these types of things. If you grew up in a different time, these are not things you thought you'd ever see, you could project that you would see happen, you know, or golf, Tiger Woods as well, right? You know, growing up in Toronto, going to school in Forest Hill as well as Little Jamaica, I have stories of, people, friends of mine's parents, you know, saying, yeah, they're going to go on the golf links, we're going to go play tennis at Viewmount, and these are times, it's pretty much all white, you know what I mean? So you didn't even really feel like, you know, and then now it's just like, yeah, you know, with the success of Tiger Woods, on the golf links, not outside, you know what I mean, some issues there.
Right.
So the same thing goes for certainly Drake, you know, as far as, carving out that path, right? Yeah. And so in the book, I do talk a lot about that, about, you know, the N-word, for example, the usage of the N-word, right? The N-word is one of the most loaded, words that a lot of rappers, they tend to, overuse. And, not to make a big, broad, sweeping overgeneralization, but most of the, you know, larger bulk of our favorite MCs and rappers, they use the word repeatedly, right? So it was an opportunity to talk about, you know, Drake's usage of the term, given that he is biracial. And a lot of the people around him, like Oliver, right, who is his stylist, Noah Shabib, one of his core producers, 40, a bunch of people around him, his mother, who he adores and cherishes, I mean, they are all, non-black. They are all non-black. They're not black. And, what happens when, Drake is like, in a lot of his hits and all that, saying the N-word all the time. Does it make his mother, who is white and Jewish, feel uncomfortable? Does she feel awkward? Or, you know, even 40, Oliver, all of the Caucasian folk around him, when he's saying it all the time and rapping and all that, do they feel uncomfortable? Are they rhyming along with him? Are they saying the N-word along with him, you know, at concerts or, you know, when he's in the studio? And it just raises a whole bunch of issues around usage of the term, because, you know, there's a whole argument about, you know, who's allowed to use it or not. If a cultural insider or somebody who's black or from a racialized community uses it, is it okay? Is it N-I-G-G-E-R, N-I-G-G-A? There's a whole bunch of issues around that. So when he uses it, it raises a whole bunch of those kinds of issues, you know, because he does use it. And I have some good quotes on him about his feelings about talking about race and using the N-word and that, and how it's interpreted by black communities, rap communities, non-black communities, racialized communities, that type of thing, right? So yeah, there's an opportunity to talk about race relations. And also, too, the fact that he is Jewish as well. I have a bit of a theory. I don't want to get too deep. You know, grab a copy of the book or, you know, whatever, or mm-hmm. go online or take it out of the library. It's available at the Murray Shuka, you know, whatever you want to do. But as far as, when we talk about the Jewish identity and him sort of essentially going to school in Forest Hill, it was an opportunity to talk about that as well. Talk about the other side, the other half of him, you know, which is the Jewish half. And in hip hop, it's there are so few. You know, I did a chapter. It's kind of like the history of Jews in hip hop. You know, the relationship of rappers, executives, and all that to the hip hop industry in general. Because what he's doing is not only blockbuster sales, and he's from Toronto, and he's biracial. All of these are sort of like an outlier. But as far as in the Jewish community itself, right? It's like he's kind of. I hear a lot of, you know, young Jewish youth, you know, hit me up online or whatever, you know, come out to a couple of my events, and they're just like, it's a feeling of a source of pride that somebody who proudly proclaims their Jewry is doing so well in music in general and rap music in particular, right? Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity to talk a lot about that. And there are so few, Jews that proclaim your Jewry in hip-hop that are coming out and saying, yeah, I'm proud to be Jewish, much like Drake is. Because Drake, he'll be at an award show and he'll say, yeah, I want to shout out my very Jewish mother, you know, sitting in the back. He was on the cover of Vibe magazine. You all know that magazine. And mm-hmm. he's wearing this pendant, you know, this chai pendant, you know, which, you know, it's a symbol around, you know, Jewish identity. He also has a video called HYFR. Yeah, hell yeah, effing right, which you've probably seen, you know, rotated everywhere. Yeah. And they shot the video in a like a Jewish religious house of worship, a shul, right? So it's the equivalent of like me, growing up in the black church, shooting a video in a church, in a house of worship, and you know, N-word, F-word, that kind of thing, right? Like it's a very, so I talk a bit about that. It's a very contentious, debate, I guess, in the community, in the Jewish community, and the music community in general, right? Is shooting a video in a house of worship, a shul, a Jewish house of worship, and the song is called "Hell Yeah, Effin' Right." And there's a lot of scantily clad women in the video. There's a lot of drinking in the video, right? There's a bunch of things going on that we consider like debauchery, and it's going on in a house of worship, right? So, something interesting, subject of debate or that I talk about in the book, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So we talk about the racial, the black,
yes.
Him being black, and people, and then also to take that further around authenticity. Sometimes when people see non-black rappers, or MCs. You have to kind of you go down this different path, because given the history and origins of the music, it's a black music of African descent. We can make the case that it goes back to West African griot traditions, and then taking it to Jamaica as far as toasting cultures, like toasting, and then to South Bronx and all that. But it's a black music, black culture. When people who aren't black, or biracial, yeah. or just non-black, sometimes they have to go through a different course and path around authenticity. You know what I mean? Like people say, like, yeah, that's not real. You know what I mean? This guy's not from the hood. This guy's not black. He's from whatever. He grew up rich, and he's South Asian. He's not hip hop, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of that you see happening in the industry even to this day.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of things related to that as well. That him being biracial, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah.
So thus far, we've talked quite a bit about his career as an MC, though you do have a second chapter mm-hmm. that you titled The Degrassi Years, in which you talk about Drake's very early career as an actor. And so can you tell us a little bit about that, a little bit about his early years on this television show? And would you argue that his opportunities and experiences in the dramatic arts have helped him prepare for his entry into the music world, or vice versa?
Yeah, I would say him definitely being a very popular child actor. A lot of us would know him through Degrassi, The Next Generation. That played a huge role as far as his entry into the music industry. I talk about it in a couple of the early chapters in the book. It sort of prepped him and primed him for being comfortable in the spotlight, right? So Degrassi, whether you all watch it or have heard about it, I grew up watching it. I think a lot of Canadian, people that mm-hmm. grew up here, not the next generation, but the earlier incarnation of Degrassi, Next Generation, grew up watching the show. In fact, a lot of kids, this is just one of those little factoids, but a lot of kids that kind of, Forest Hill, North Toronto, Northern, it seemed to be a lot of them had been cast there, because I kind of grew up with kids way before Drake, obviously, that worked on Degrassi, right? So the few folk of color that were on Degrassi way back in the days, like, during its inception, and in the 80s and 90s, I actually hung out with and knew quite well, So I was very comfortable, I understood that it's like a cult of Degrassi, right? It doesn't matter what generation of it, they have, made-for-television movies, specials, and it's been going on forever, but there's a Degrassi has a little bit of a cult following, right? Whether you're into it or not. And, because it has consistently high ratings, he had already had this massive fan base, right? So before, you want to, jump on the mic, start recording tracks, jump into studios, and I talk a lot about that in the book, all the people that he started recording, going to his first experiences in studios, he had this large Degrassi audience, a larger listenership that tuned in to watch him as Jimmy Brooks, right? So him now, when he goes on and sets up, MySpace pages and all that, he already has a built-in audience, right? Most rappers do not have that that kind of thing at their disposal, where you have a built-in audience from another medium, which would be television in this case, right? Most rappers are like, okay, I'm Dalton Rapper. I'm a Francesca D'Amico Rapper. Okay, world, do you want to hear my new tracks, right? This guy had a built-in listenership, so to speak, right, that he cultivated to today. So that had a lot to do, certainly, with his comfort around the music industry and, essentially his rapid ascent. The other thing, too, I think, with Degrassi is, the thing that connects Degrassi to his career is I got some very good insight from people that worked with him, before he, totally blew up. And while he was working on Degrassi, he had always wanted to be a rapper, because people were thinking, he's a good actor. He was scoring some roles in feature films and that kind of thing. But this is what he always wanted to do. So he would always privately and secretly, privately say to people, like, yeah, Degrassi is fine, it's making good money, but I want to be the best rapper in the world. You know what I mean? Like, this is, so he had a lot of focus. And this is a kid who dared to dream, you know? And I think that's the fascination for me around Drake is he really dared to dream. Because how many people that are sort of, you know, living, you know, more cushy, you know? It's like, you know, Degrassi's doing well. You know, he does say that, you know, he said ultimately, you know, he'd like to play Barack Obama, you know, like in a made-for-television movie, you know, but he'd probably have to compete with Will Smith or something like that or whatever. But his acting career, yeah. So I think that's what it is. He came into the music industry with a built-in audience, and who can do that? Nobody. You know, there's a guy named Childish Gambino, who's an actor, you know, comedian, what have you. He's another guy, another current MC. You want to look at his career, Childish Gambino, because he has a built-in audience. And then he's like, now, okay, I'm a comedian, I'm an actor, now I'm a rapper. So I already have a couple hundred thousand people, you know, or on Twitter, I already have a couple mil. Now I can just translate this, bring my, bring the folk who had grown comfortable in my acting career, bring them over into my music world. And then you have a million people there that are going to go support your music produce, you know, so yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a, before we jump into a little bit more history, I have a little bit of a tidbit. So recently, I was watching a 1996 CBC interview with Ron Nelson and DJX. And for those of you who do not know about Toronto music history, these two guys are kind of, they're super important to a radio station, a little known hip-hop radio station, that plays hip-hop by the name of CKLN. But they're also hugely important to the promotion of Toronto hip-hop and hip-hop in Canada. And so in this particular interview, they described the history of Canadian hip-hop as being a long one, which is, you know, maybe a surprise to some, but shouldn't be. So it's long, diverse, fruitful, and in many occasions, very challenging. And Ron Nelson in particular, actually, fascinatingly in this interview from 1996, predicts then that it's going to be 10 years from that very interview, so that would make it 2006, when an MC from Canada or from Toronto is going to powerfully penetrate the American music market. Fascinating, because that's actually just around the time when Drake, or slightly thereafter, I should say, that Drake begins to penetrate the American music market. So can you, for us, as one of the foremost urban music journalists in Canada, talk to us a little bit about the nature and the course of Toronto hip-hop music and its development in this city? And tell us what you think were the necessary preconditions for the rise of this, or as you term it, the Drake phenomenon.
Right. Yeah, well, I would say, I think that some of the success of Drake, I don't want it to lull us into a false sense of security around the Canadian music industry supports of local or indigenous rap talents, or the broader industry supports of local talents. I think they're a bit of a smokescreen. So people tend to think when they look at the success of, let's go back to, you know, Michi Me, Maestro, Cardinal Official.
We got Chris Jackson, we did, I think.
Yeah, I saw it.
We had Chris Jackson in the room, yeah.
Exactly. When you look at the success of, Chaos, anybody into Chaos here, you look at the success of just all of these people who have, you know, has a reasonable amount of success. That success, you know, one can argue, and I do argue with some success, is that it doesn't really come from the support of Canadians per se, right? That's not where. So Michi Me, the first person to get signed to an American recording contract, right? She got signed to an American recording contract, okay? First Priority Records, right? It's an American company, okay? Maestro, right? Maestro Fresh West, you know, Let Your Backbone Slide. It's an American company. It's a company called LMR Records, right? Cardinal Official, right? It's Universal Music, right? Chaos, it's Capital EMI in LA, right? So all of your favorite Canadian rappers, right? Or hip-hop practitioners that are doing quite well for themselves, you know, as far as having chart-topping hits, or they get the respect in the streets or in the hood. It's not from the Canadian music industry that they're getting those supports, right? The same argument is for Drake, is that Drake, if not for Lil Wayne's cosign and him being aligned, you know, certainly Cash Money Records, would he get treated the same way, your typical sort of rock and roll country and folk artists are in Canada, and get, you know, and somebody throw, you know, a million or a couple million dollars at him with a Canadian record company? I would argue no. So as far as that, yeah, I don't, you know, let's not, you say in the hip-hop parlance, you know, get it twisted, you know, around them. Yeah, Canada, yeah, Canadian is the greatest place for, you know, rap music produce. I beg to differ, because most of, again, the people that I like and have worked with, including Chaos, Cardinal, most of these rappers, I've written their bios. I've written the bios for all of them, you know, for the most part. And the success, the checks are getting cut from American companies. It's not from Canadian, it's not from Universal Music Canada, it's not from, you know, Warner, you know, Music Group in Canada, it's not from, you know, Virgin, you know, that's not who I largely attribute a lot of their success to. It's people in America having the insight and foresight to kind of say, whoa, these rappers in Toronto are doing something big here, you know, even somebody like Chaos. I remember... there's an ex basketball player, used to play for the Detroit Pistons. His name is John Sally, John Spider Sally, right? So he played with the Detroit Pistons, you know, the Bad Boys. You know, they won a couple back-to-back NBA championships, you know, Detroit Pistons, just you know, very close to here. And John Sally was messing around with Chaos before a lot of, you know, Canadian music industry executives even really cared, right? And John Sally, he also had hosted a lot of shows, American television, just Google him, but he's a very, very well-known entity in the U.S. He's hosted television shows in L.A., you know, in the U.S., and played for you know, he's made a lot of money and what have you. But yeah, he was hanging out here in Toronto, and he was playing for the Raptors, actually, at the time, right? Mm-hmm. He had a little, you know, a small, short contract with the Raptors. He's about 6'11", big dude, you know, and he was supporting Chaos's music, you know, initiatives back then, right? So when if you pull aside and talk to a lot of the so-called Canadian success stories, Cardinal Official, you know, that's my homie. You know, ask Cardinal Official, ask him, you know, where, you know, as far as getting that real stamp of approval, getting fiscal supports, meaning getting budgets to actually record stuff, and he's going to tell you, you know, it's going to be like, yeah, it's convict music, it's Akon, you know, it's other things. It's not really Toronto that is giving them that support to blow up the way they did. You know what I mean? So yeah, so I think there's, so you know, so in the book I spent some time trying to debunk a lot of that mythology around, you know, like Canada. Yeah, it's a hotbed of urban music, and you know, and it's going to be the new epicenter of you know, Canadian rap, you know, rap music. There's still a lot of problems with radio. Canadian commercial radio does very little to nothing to support, you know, Canadian, you know, like black music, produce, urban music in general. Very little, right? Very little. And most musicians, if you talk to them, they will tell you the same. You know, you know, good luck trying to get your music heard outside of G98.7, which is, you know, the new, you know, black community radio station. It's only been around not long, Flow 93.5. Good luck trying to get your music heard on those other radio stations. It's not going to get heard, right? And all of the aforementioned artists that I just mentioned, you know, they all have horror stories, you know, and these are the ones that have experienced great success, you know, is trying to get radio airplay. Next to near impossible. Trying to get interest of record companies here, right? So we have these big major multinational companies trying to get that interest here. It's nothing. It's not, you know, you have a better chance, just like I had a better chance, in fact, you know, when you open up a discussion around, you know, reporting and journalism and all that, I got a lot of my first breaks writing for American music magazines, just so you know. So here, you know, I went to York University. I'm a York alumni, and trying to get gigs, you know, writing, journalism, and all that, and it's just like, it was actually going to a conference in the U.S. and hooking up with people, and then I started getting work opportunities in the U.S., right? And then after writing for The Source for many years, The Source, which used to be called the Bible of hip-hop culture, it's still out there and doing its thing. It's a glossy, available on newsstands, Vibe magazine, you know, I'd written for a bunch of stuff, Herb magazine, that's when now Canada or Toronto, now it's like, oh yeah, hey, Dalton, hey, we have some journalists here, you know what I mean? It was after doing work in the U.S., to be perfectly honest, right? So the story of the Cardinal Official and all these, you know, Mishimi, it's the same, that's my narrative as well as a journalist and as an author. It's only after doing a lot of work in the U.S., interviewing, you know, like Jay Dilla, Slum Village. I'm the guy who did his first, you know, national interview, right? Jay Dilla, The Source, you know, people like Nelly, you know, from St. Louis. Like, I was the guy who, you know, the first interview, period. Like, never mind Canadian, but the first to get in there and knock out these interviews for The Source magazine. It was only then now that now, you know, I could get work in my hometown. You know what I'm trying to say? So this is the kind of country we live in. We have to be very careful, you know, when we talk about success and, you know, and the Canadian supports behind it. We'd be very careful. Yeah.
So, what a perfect segue, talking about media.
Yeah.
You dedicate a significant portion of your book to various forms of media and the industry at large and how these play their role and have their effects on hip-hop culture and the hip-hop world, broadly speaking. But you also talk about how they have affected Drake. And so you highlight things like print media, journalists, and perhaps, I think most strongly, you highlight the role of social media in Drake's career. Can you talk to us a little bit about the importance of these forms of media and technology and the changing role that media has had on an artist's success or path to success, and the role that they have had in connecting audiences to these artists?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as far as social media, you know, yeah, Drake and his camp and crew, that's like, you know, social media gangsters, you know, because they have so much clout, you know, like in it, however you choose to measure, you know, social media clout. I think, you know, Drake represents kind of like a paradigm shift, right? So there was a time, you know, in the music industry, you know, while I was writing for The Source and Vibe, where, you know, you spent all of your time. In fact, let me tell you a story. The Source magazine, there was a time where if you get your CD reviewed in The Source, right? So they used to have this system, you know, mics, you know, like they say, it's, you know, it's out of five mics, right? So if you get three mics, you know, that would be like, I don't know, 60%. Like, you get four out of five mics, you know, and that would say that this is a classic CD, right? So most artists were fixated and obsessed with this concept of, yeah, if The Source, and this is the world of hip-hop, because this is at a time when The Source magazine is the Bible of hip-hop culture, you get your CD reviewed in The Source and it gets a favorable review, you know, your career is going to take off like this, right? Now Drake represents, and I talk about in the first couple chapters, he represents a paradigm shift where Drake's concerned, it really doesn't matter what magazines think. It doesn't matter what, like, let's say the Globe and Mail, National Post, you know, Toronto Star, let's say they absolutely loathe Drake's CDs, right? They're not interested in it. They don't review it. They don't interview him. And if they do, they don't give it a favorable review. That doesn't even really matter now in 2012. And so the social media thing is real. I mean, I think that's something he got in the early, you know, in his early rise. I think he really got that in that when he had his MySpace page up, when MySpace was still relevant, you know, like who here is still on MySpace? I mean, that's pretty much dead, you know, with all due respect to MySpace. Because I think Justin Timberlake is, you know, still one of the chief proprietors behind it. But that's dead, you know, MySpace. I haven't looked at mine in, I don't know, years, right? But he was a guy that was able to kind of, you know, and I talk about it, I don't want to reveal too much, but let's just say that he really got the power and importance of social media, of having people, not having to rely on media to sort of dictate, you know, to cultivate your own listenership, right? How to cultivate your own listenership. He really got that, right? And that you look now, I haven't looked at his Twitter account in quite some time, maybe a couple weeks, but, you know, he was into like about 9.5 million, I believe, Twitter followers, right? So when you're able to sort of leverage and translate that, like if I have a new track, I mean, just think about this for a second. Let's think about the 90s. Let's think about early 2000, maybe up to about 2004, I'd say. I put out a CD. I'm Dalton Rapper. I put out a CD. I'm like, is the Toronto Star going to review it? That's how people are going to know I have a record. Is whatever, Urbanology going to review it? This is the only means by which to have people, you know that you have a CD out and that you can go buy it at some you know, commercial outlet or download it or whatever. And then you shift over to now where it's like, you know, once you build up your social media clout like he's always done, he would put up, you know, he would have a new tracks up on MySpace page and there's like a couple hundred thousand people on there that are going to tune in and that are already attuned to him, his career and his music, that are going to listen to that track, right? So this is what I spend a lot of time talking about. Also, so social media trends in that him coming from Canada, and I don't know if you all know this or not, but Canada is one of has always been, over the last 8 years, one of the most wired countries on the planet, right? So when we look at, you know, connectability, and we talk about, you know, even when we talk about high-speed use and this kind of thing, Canada's always ranked high, right? So it's usually like Japan, and then, you know, some other country in Asia, it could be China, Canada, right? 2008, it's like Canada's the leading when I'm talking about wired, about people having access to smartphones, you know, or gadgets and connectivity, right? Canada is always one of the world leaders in that area. So I have a bunch of theories that I put together, right? So artists here, like let's say you come from Albania or you come from, you're a rapper from Turkey, you know what I mean? Or from Sri Lanka, right? Lebanese rapper. The argument that I make is that we're able to, you know, Canadians as rappers, if you're, is sort of leverage our social media and our web expertise because we are such a wired nation. Again, we're one of the world leaders when it comes to, right, internet use. Like, those are the facts. That's not me making this up. You can just even Google that. You know, what countries have the highest rates of connectivity? And Canada always rates top five, right? So Canada sort of set the stage. We, you know, that's part of one of the conditions that I think we have set up here to have these MCs that are so social media infused, that are so concerned about how many followers they have on Twitter. Are people checking out their stuff on Facebook? Although there's a limit to how many people you can have on, you know, for likes and that on Facebook. You know, YouTube pages, Tumblr, that type of thing. Is Canada is ideally suited and equipped because everybody here is wired around the clock, way more so than other nations, right? There's also another theory. When we talk about social media use, statistically, and I go into this as far as him being, he's biracial, you know, black, is that black youth are, you know, some of the leading, users, you know, like of social media, right? So they say when you look at different communities, you know, if you look at the Asian community, Caucasian, what have you, black youth, he fits the demographic of the people that that engage social media the most, right? Which is black youth. Right? Yeah, we're leaders in that area. Yeah, so that's an interesting thing as well, right? So there are all these things going on at play, right? Where I talk about people aren't so much thinking about, you know, New York hip hop anymore, you know, as much, to be honest, as being the epicenter at all. Maybe not LA at all either, you know, with the exception of Kendrick Lamar and a couple other MCs there. They're looking to new places, right? So there are a bunch of things happening, a bunch of conditions happening now that sort of create Drake, right? Is the country, is the whole biracial kind of thing happening there? Is connectivity, which I talk about, social media, is that in Canada, we're world leaders in that area. So if you hear about rappers blowing up and they have all, you know what I mean? They're able to, it's going to be from places like here, you know? So yeah.
Okay. So, and in talking about connectivity and Drake building this audience, one of the things that I found, particularly as I was kind of building hype around this, even this event, and I've known this for a while anyhow, right, being in Toronto and being a fan of Drake, is that Toronto hip-hop fans have very mixed feelings about Drake. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, there are many people who readily embrace him, and part of that is because of his insistence on Toronto being his city, right, in quotations. And then there's others who have much to criticize. And we saw this perhaps most prominently last year in his, he had what in hip hop we call a beef, right? Or an argument with the rapper Common from Chicago, in which he just raked him over the coals. And Common, of course, is one of the nastiest freestyle beef MCs that has ever hit the hip hop world. Mm-hmm. And so there's that, right? This issue of, how many people love Drake? Is Drake really repped in Toronto to the degree that we think he is? And so what's fascinating to me is we have people who feel this way about Drake. And this is part of a history in hip-hop, right? Where MCs really do believe it important to bring attention to their cities, to their neighborhoods. And in many cases, as you've mentioned with someone like Cardinal Fischel, they act as ambassadors, right, to their cities or to their countries. So in a global market where Drake is very often constructed as a representative of Toronto in the world, how might we be able to understand him as a Canadian cultural export? Or do you think that this kind of pressure to be that export is an expectation that is an unfair and burdensome one on an artist like Drake?
Right, totally. I think by default, if you grew up here or born here, I think by default, because there are so few global success stories as far as Canadian rappers or rappers from Toronto, you know, localize this blowing up and doing so well in the area of he's arguably, you know, one of the leading newsmakers, not just in music or from amongst Canadians or just in music in general. He's one of the leading newsmakers, period, right? So you can't open up a newspaper or go on some site, you know, that deals in popular culture or news items and not see Drake show up or Justin Bieber, who's also from Ontario, from Stratford. I talk about that as well. Again, when you have, you know, two people from Ontario, Justin Bieber and Drake, and what I'm suggesting to you all is, in my prior, my old job, I spent a lot of time traveling around the world, and that's when you see the impacts. It's not here. It's not here. It's that you see the impacts when you go elsewhere, right? When you go to Sevilla, Spain, you know, which I've been. Copenhagen, which I've been, right? When you go to, Essen, Germany, right? I have a lot of stories. That's when you see the impacts. Yeah, it's not here. It's when you go there and people understand, you know, they say, oh, you're from Toronto. What's going on there? And they go, yeah, do you know Drake? You know, are you... You know what I mean? It's the first thing they ask you. You know what I mean? You know, Kanan? Like, it's crazy. It's going outside of these borders, right? That's when you see the impacts, right? Now, as far as this whole idea around being a Canadian rap ambassador and all that, I mean, I think that's it could be a bit burdensome, and I think it's an unfair, thing that's sort of pushed onto rappers that just happen to be from here. What I find is, it's interesting, you know, I'm into sports, you know, when I'm not recording on popular culture, music culture, I like sports, and because Toronto, you know, Toronto is arguably the most multicultural city on the planet, and it's something we kind of pride ourselves in, but we're conflicted when it comes to identity. I mean, if you go to a soccer, I mean, they're, like when I look at this audience, this is like some United Nations type thing going on here, right? This is Toronto, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, this is Toronto, truly, right? There are people here, like, who here is from, you know, a continent from Africa, you know, like the continent of Africa? Okay, good. The Caribbean, by show of hands. Okay, Latin America. Okay, Middle East. Okay, Europe or Eastern European. All right, Europe, right? Okay, you see what I mean, though? Yeah, this is the United Nations right here. This is Toronto. You know what I mean? This is Toronto I know, right? And back to, no, I wanted to say something very specific there. I was going off.
About an export.
As an export. As an ambassador. So what I find is that, you know, if I go to, you know, I'm again, my parents are Jamaican. If I go to like a soccer game, you know, where Jamaica plays Canada in soccer, you know, in football, at Lamport Stadium, you know, the Reggae Boys or whatever, right? Is that despite, you know, being born here, you know, like, and, you know, and some of my friends would have been, you know, born in Canada, born in Toronto, or maybe came here at a young age, is that when you go in the stands, you know, they have the Jamaican flags raised, you know what I mean? Like, they're voting for Jamaica, right? So, you know, or let's say, you know what I mean, the soccer game, I mean, like, Ethiopia is playing Canada, you're going to see Ethiopian flags. No, I'm just being honest here. This is what I see. Or Italy, or, you know, only because I lived through the, you know, when Italy won the World Cup, 84, and then...
82.
That's right. Yeah, because you're from, exactly, you know, 82.
2006.
Okay, see, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, there. So the thing is, so despite a lot of kids from, you know, I went to Oakwood Collegiate, and, you know, kids there that were born in Toronto, but of Italian descent, it's kind of like they're cheering for Italy, straight up, you know what I mean? And that's what I've seen across communities, across this United Nations. You know, if I'm Colombian and Colombia is playing Canada, I'm voting for, you know, I'm cheering on Colombia. So we have this sort of conflicted idea around, you know, like, define, you know, or feeling Canadian, you know, or feeling, am I Canadian, you know, like, what is a Canadian, you know? So there are a lot of unresolved issues that relate to certainly racism, I think. You know, in racial hierarchies, race does matter. So we're very conflicted around our identity. So I think, you know, let's use Kanan, for example. You know, he's out there, you know, waving flag and all that. And he seems to me to be, you know, arguably more interested and invested in what's happening in Somalia, based on, you know, his lyrics, what he's talking about, some of the subject matter, maybe some of the things he attaches himself to, some of the imagery in his video, some of the things the video is not, like, you know, people around him, to things happening on the continent of Africa, and or Somalia in particular, then he would be attached to Toronto, you know? So this is what I'm suggesting. So when people say, yeah, Kanan, Canadian rapper, again, Canadians, we have this conflicted, you know, like how we choose to self-identify. You know, I think Cardinal Fischel, you did a great interview for the book, but I think he kind of, you know, sums a lot of it up best, you know, around this idea of there being a Canadian rap movement. He kind of, I guess, you know, begs to differ without revealing too much. But this idea, like, for there to be a truly uniquely Canadian rap movement, you have to be repping, you know, like how people rep New York, like, you know what I mean? Like, people, one thing about the New York rap scene, or, you know, LA, wherever you come from, Memphis, Tennessee, St. Louis, is that they, we talk about repping your hood, they rep their hood, they rep their city, right? Alicia Keys, Jay-Z, you know, New York. Like, you're right, the anthem, and, you know, it's a different thing. It's a different thing, you know? Mm-hmm. I see a renewed sense of pride and commitment to the city now, though. You know, kids are now, you know, as far as, like, hip-hop, you know, rocking Toronto gear, Raptors, you know what I mean, right? Raptors snapbacks, One Love T.O. I see a renewed sense of, you know, interest and commitment in the city, which is great, right? But again, I think, Cardinal was essentially saying that a lot of rappers, it's not like they're really coming together or forming coalitions, working together to create this Canadian rap movement, much like New York. Like, when you represent Brooklyn, Queensbridge, you know what I mean? I reference Nas.
Yes.
There's a whole bunch of things going on. There's Cormega, there's, you know what I mean? Like, it's a neighborhoodism and neighborhood movements, city movements. You know what I mean? It's not like kind of like, yeah, I'm successful by my lonesome, self-serving. It's all about me. I'm going to make $22 million a year and not care so much about Queensbridge or care about Long Island or care about, you know what I mean, Brooklyn, Boogie Down Bronx. Like, it's, you know, in New York, it's more feelings around a neighborhoodism, a more communal feeling, which is hip-hop. I don't know if I really see that so much here as far as people waving a, you know, they're waving other flags, but I don't know if it's a Canadian flag. Cardinal Official, that being said, I think that guy is real, to me, I think the most genuine, authentic kind of like Canadian rap ambassador, because he was celebrating how proud it is to be for a Toronto rapper. Before it became cool to do so, right? So before there's, you know, One Love T.O. and before people wearing Raptors snapback hats and, you know, Argos jerseys, right? Grey Cup, you know what I mean? Right? Nice. Yeah. That was beautiful. Before it became cool and trendy to do that, Cardinal Fischel was out there touring internationally and wearing the Canadian and also Jamaican, you know, like flag on his chest. So that guy to me is like a genuine Canadian rap ambassador because he was doing it before it was cool, before the bandwagonism, you know. Now it's like, yeah, one. Now, in fact, there are a lot of, you know, sites now that sort of have, you know, T.O. and it's, you know, it's like kind of like, you know, yeah, hip hop T.O. Like there's just a ton of, you know, now, which is great, but it's, you know, so I would argue that some of it is just sort of like a bandwagonism because of some of the successes. I don't know, like it doesn't feel, some of it doesn't feel real to me. And it feels that once some of the focus shifts away from Toronto, those sites will get pulled down, you know, and then they'll, right, different domain names. You know, you get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Whereas Cardinal is like a genuine, it's like, yeah, I'm proud to be from this place, you know, grow up. And he actually used to live in the neighborhood, mm-hmm, too, you know, a lot of stories,
yeah,
there. But yeah, he used to live just down the street as well.
Yes, So we've now come to the last question before I'd like to open it up to the audience for questions. And that is about the title. So you've appropriately titled this, mm-hmm, book, Far From Over, in which I think what you're doing is trying to signal to your readers that though Drake has had a profitable and fruitful career thus far, he really does have staying power and potential. If not in hip-hop, certainly in other kind of mediums like television or film and that sort of thing. Can you tell us about what you believe Drake's legacy is to date? And perhaps more importantly, for those of us in the room who are interested in the local music market and the national music market, what you think his story thus far tells us about the history, the future, I should say, of hip-hop in Canada?
Yeah, I think Drake, you know, because, yeah, the book is a bit of a celebration, you know, of his accomplishments, to be honest. It's like my own literary tribute as somebody who's been worked with most prominent sort of Canadian rappers and hip-hop culture practitioners. It's a bit of a literary tribute in that sense. I think he still has a long way to go, though. I think for folk that, you know, millennials, you know, like that, you know, the millennial generation, they'll say, yeah, that's the, you know, somebody would have put out like, you know, one CD and then, yeah, he's the greatest rapper of all time. He's put out two mixtapes and we are like, and it's just, you know, so whereas I come from a time where you have to build up a bit of a catalog of music. So, you know, there's this pop culture impresario, Andy Warhol, you know, we talk about, he coined this term about there being like a 15 minutes of fame. You know, everybody has 15 minutes of fame and then it's like nobody cares about you or whatever. So a lot of musicians today, not Drake, but I mean just in general, they're like, yeah, they put out two great mixtapes and then they think they're the greatest of all time. So I don't, you know, by that measure, you know, I think, yeah, he has a long way to go. And that's why we titled it Far From Over. This is just a kind of... the book is essentially just putting a mirror to his reality as it is today, hoping that he will continue to produce, you know, put out a lot more, you know, CDs, whether they're major label endorsed through Cash Money, Universal Republic or not. That's irrelevant. That's a moot point. But I think it's just to essentially say, okay, you know, there's a legacy. You're starting to build a legacy. But for most rappers and millennials, you know, let's not drink our own Kool-Aid, you know, like you've made your money and, you know, waving flag and all that, but you've put out two CDs, like, you know what I mean? Like you haven't, when I look at some of the, and there are even books in this lovely bookstore about when we look at the, yeah, people, you know, Stevie Wonder, you just go through the ranks. You know, I was watching something about Michael Jackson the other day. Mm-hmm. It was the Bad 25 film that Spike Lee directed and, we talk about icons, iconoclasts, people whose legacy will live way beyond, their own generation. You have to put out just a lot more collaborations, a lot more in both in quantity and in quality, you know. I think so. That's what I talk about. Just I think it, you know, sort of the, you know, some of the last chapters is just how some creative ways he can, you know, build, maybe give some suggestions, you know, build his own legacy. You know, I also think and that Andy Warhol thing is real. That 15 minutes of fame, because what I find now, yeah, kids will come up to me. I mentor a lot of youth. You know what I mean? In writing and music, and it's amazing because, you know, they think they made it. You know, they get a bunch of, you know, they haven't done anything really, but they feel they've made it. But I think, it's a lot more work to be done. And also, too, I think as far as his whole acting career, you know, I talk a bit about that, is that, yeah, I think that's something his representatives, you know, as far as his agents and what have you, William Morris, and they want him to, you know, ultimately, once, I guess, the music career dies down, that, you know, to get, you know, more big acting gigs, right? Because he had mentioned that a couple of years ago, which I found fascinating, is that he'd love to play Barack Obama, you know, because he could relate to him as this big, globally recognized figure, Who happens to be biracial as well, and mm-hmm. you know, there are all these, I guess, sort of parallels, you know, I guess he was sort of, you know, projecting some parallels in their lives, right. you know, so, but I think the acting thing, I think that's going to take off, and I think also being this sort of, what makes him rare and unique is, you know, it's things related to his lineage, you know, where he's coming from, is that not a lot of us can say that we have an uncle, like he does, his uncle Larry Graham Jr., that is, you know, Prince's mentor. You know what I'm trying to say? So, you know, Prince, everybody loves Prince. Like, he's comparable to, like, Michael Jackson. Those figures that just transcend generations, you know? And, you know, yeah, his uncle is Prince's mentor. You know what I'm trying to say? So, clearly there are a lot of things at play, you know, like as far as timing, zeitgeist, you know, mm-hmm. happening for him to be where he is now. As far as, you know, so him not just being, you know, singularly like a musician or rapper, I think that's where a lot of the, you know, as far as revenue-generating streams are going to come from. It's not even going to be from music. It's going to be from building up his brand, the OVO, October's Very Own brand. It's going to come from places like that. Because he is one of those, he's a legitimate, genuine, you know, very talented triple threat, you know. And it's not too many people you could point to that, you know, again, because he's an actor. He's a formerly trained actor, right? So he was doing stuff with the Young People's Theater. Like, you know, he's an actor. He can pretty much shut down the rap music career tomorrow. And just go off into the acting world, because that's how he essentially got his start,
right.
And generated some interest in the media and otherwise, and his fan base and brand. You know, it's through acting. It's not through music. You know what I mean? So, if he didn't record another CD, he would still be, you know, it's like, you know, acting. So he's a genuine triple threat that way too. And there are only very few people you could count on one hand. You know, not just in the so-called urban music world, but just in general that can. That are effective, you know, vocalists, because he sings a lot of hooks. You notice he likes to sing, and he was actually supposed to put out an R&B album, you know, with Trey Songz, you know, just singing, because, you know, he likes to sing, and you see he sings a lot of his hooks and all that, he, you know, as a vocalist, right? So he's a singer, he's definitely an MC, as we already know, and he's also an actor. So those are three things that he's quite comfortable performing, those three genres, those three disciplines, right? So this guy, you know what I mean? This is why he is to be celebrated, you know, by I think, most Canadians, right? He's not just some rapper or some Forest Hill guy. This guy has a real sort of deep, rich, profound story. Right. Whereas some of the other people we talked about, you know, they're more like, you know, I'm a rapper, you know what I mean? But I'm a great rapper, and I do it well, and I'm signed to a recording contract, I'm making great money, I'm touring the world. But this guy, yeah, he's an actor. You know, he makes that, you know, acting money, you know, passive income, you know, checks coming in from acting gigs, music, and then singing hooks on other people's, you know what I mean, like records, right? So yeah, that's, yeah.
Fantastic. So I'd like to take this opportunity to now close this portion of the evening, the discussion between Dalton and I, and I'd like to convey our greatest gratitude to Dalton for sharing with us tonight his wonderfully insightful work, and for talking with us about this book and things beyond this book. So I'd like to now give him a round of applause. Thank you very much. Also, I'd like to take a few moments to just thank the people who are part of putting this event together tonight. So the first thank you I'd like to give is to Abu Bakr, who's sitting right here in the back with us, and Michelle, who are the owners of Accents on Eglinton, for offering to us their bookstore this evening to let us have a venue to put this together. Also, a big hip-hop shout-out right here in the front to Amanda and the ladies at badperm.com for joining us and for covering this event. Badperm.com, for those of you who do not know, is a wonderful website run entirely by female hip-hop experts who write about the music from a woman's perspective, and they will be featuring a write-up about this event hopefully in the week to come. Thirdly, I'd like to give another hip-hop shout-out to ActiveHistory.ca, a website that connects the work of historians with the public, policymakers, and the media. Active History has graciously offered to record this evening's discussion, one that will be on their website in the coming weeks as a podcast. And finally, I'd like to thank Kathy, who's located in the back over there, who has helped us with tonight's social media promotion and has helped us, acted as almost our resident DJ, giving us those Drake tunes at the top of the night and hopefully at the end of the evening as well. So thank you to all of those. And again, a big thank you, obviously, to Dalton, but also to all of you who have come to share in this experience with us. It was very much an engaging and enriching experience for myself, and I'm sure for everyone in the room.
Okay.
So thank you very much once again.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of An Evening with Dalton Higgins. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.